From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Coming up on the show today, a Milwaukee researcher examines the broad importance of early childhood education programs.
In early childhood, I think one of our hallmarks is that we do think about serving kids and their families, not just kids.
Then actor turned travel writer turned novelist Andrew McCarthy writes about a 15-year-old girl who heads on a road trip to escape some chaos in her life.
I tried not to feel parental toward her because I tried to just follow her and keep up with her. I mean, it was the only time I've ever written anything where I didn't know how sentences were going to end when I started them, which was very exciting. The only thing I did right in the book was that I just had faith in process and just stepped out on each thing that she did.
Plus, we'll have the latest episode of our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend comes your way next. News is first. Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Here's something you might not know.
Wisconsin does not require kids to go to school until they're 5 years old. That means preschool isn't mandatory here, but plenty of families still choose to send their 3- and 4-year-olds to early childhood programs to give them an early start on their education.
But not every family can afford an extra year of school. One program in Milwaukee is working to change that. EduCare provides early childhood educational programming for kids ages 6 weeks to 5 years, specifically targeting kids from low-income families. It's an offshoot of Head Start, one of the most prominent publicly funded early childhood programs in the country.
A team of national researchers recently published a study in the Journal of Child Development touting the effectiveness of EduCare schools, including the only program in Milwaukee operated out of the Next Door Foundation on the city's northwest side.
Lake Effect's Rachel Morello sat down with one of the researchers, Dr. Nancy File, a professor of early childhood education at UWM. File shared some of the best practices she studied, in particular those that she sees as critical for setting up young kids for success as they go forward in school.
EduCare provides care and education before kids hit public school. EduCares have one thing in common, and that's that they all receive Head Start and early Head Start funding. But beyond that, what they have in common is it's like Head Start, early Head Start amped up. So there's additional funding at each site, but basically allows for the center to operate at a higher level than your typical Head Start or early Head Start that's funded only through federal funds. So the teachers are more highly educated. There are more teachers in a classroom. There's an emphasis on involving parents and families. And then each program also has a local evaluator who works with the program to feed data back in to the program for short-term looking at the kids, how they're doing, long-term looking at the program and what may need to change, what's going well, etc.
You had 5 cities that you were looking at EduCare programs?
Four.
How does Milwaukee's compare to those other 3?
Okay, so we had 4 cities involved in the study: Omaha, Tulsa, Chicago, and Milwaukee. And the reason those 4 cities were chosen was because they have the oldest and most established EduCare sites. So they've been doing it the longest. Differences, the state differences are less important in EduCare because EduCare will go above and beyond any licensing. So all EduCares have 3 teachers. They have 8 children in infant toddler and 17 children in preschool rooms. They need to meet the Head Start regulations, so they come together around that. And they need to meet the philosophy of EduCare. The biggest differences among those sites are the demographics. In both Omaha and in Tulsa, there are a significant number of Spanish speakers amongst the families. In Chicago and Milwaukee, it's almost all African American families. But they're all living at the poverty level because they all qualify for early Head Start funding.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier, too, the difference in the training of the teachers. So when you're looking for a qualified teacher, what qualifications are you looking at here?
So EduCare asks that each classroom have a bachelor's level prepared teacher. EduCare also has 3 teachers. So that second teacher is ideally prepared with an associate's degree. Whereas in a Head Start center, that second teacher may have a high school diploma and perhaps some training. Whether we're looking at infant and toddler or preschool, it changes a little bit. Infant and toddler, we need teachers who are able to relate to very young children, provide that really responsive care that when they're tired, they get to take a nap, and when they're hungry, they can eat. And when they're up and awake, they're provided with activities and materials that are going to meet their need to be curious and to find out more about the world. Educare also asks that all children during their infant toddler years have continuity of care. And that means that they are with the same teachers for as long as possible.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because that was a continuity of care was a term I kept hearing when I was there. That's not something we always get in elementary school or middle school. So why is it so important when you are in that preschool age or that early education age?
The idea is that if you are going to have responsive care, you've got to really know the baby. And that baby also has to have a trusting relationship in the caregiver. In many centers, child care centers, kids are moved fairly frequently because when they turn a certain age, whether it's 12 months or 18 months, now all of a sudden you can have more children per caregiver. Or maybe it's, okay, now you walked, and so you're going to go with a different group than before you were mobile and walking. And so the norm is a great deal of change. So the idea is that rather than constantly getting used to new adults and having adults who are learning you in terms of your cues, what makes you tick, what you're interested in, what frustrates you, that the longer you preserve that relationship, the better off children will be. And the easier it is, not just for the caregiver to provide good care, but for the families to have that trusting relationship of, I know who this is, I completely trust them with my child.
You mentioned the parents, and that was another question I wanted to ask. The parental involvement, what's happening in EduCare to keep parents involved that's not happening elsewhere, other than obviously, like you said, establishing those relationships with their teachers?
Yeah, so the relationships are important. I think also the emphasis on families. In early childhood, I think, one of our hallmarks is that we do think about serving kids and their families, not just kids. In our preparation programs, we always have a class on working with families, which not all teacher education people get. So we have to think about what they have time for, what makes sense to them, what information they need, what information they have to give us, because they have a picture of their child that we never see at home. And the more that information can be shared, people can feel like they're on the same page working together to help that child have the best life possible, we think that the greater the benefits overall. In addition, parents begin to learn more about their own child when they see them through the eyes of a teacher. Like, oh my gosh, she's really capable of that. I never knew because I never tried. Or look at what she's learned. You know, that the more contact, the more awareness you have of who your child is becoming, because you don't see them in the classroom as much.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, this is a program for low-income families, especially when we talk about the achievement gap in Milwaukee and how stark that is here compared to some other cities. What do you think Milwaukee as a city could benefit from if more kids who are in those low-income situations had access to programs like EduCare? Do you think it would make a big difference?
I think that one of the things that we know is poverty is hard on children and it's hard on families. And the more that we can support families and children to navigate those difficulties, the better off everyone is. So many parents in EduCare work, and yet they still qualify for Head Start services, which means you are at the poverty level. So helping parents by saying, here is a place where you can trust while you're off trying to make as much money as you can or get job training or whatever, is an important resource for you. And all EduCares and also Head Starts have a mission of saying, what other resources do families need? How can we connect them to the things that will help them achieve their own goals for themselves and their families?
So it sounds like marketing those additional things is what might set apart an EduCare or a Head Start program mm-hmm. from, say, a home-based care program or
right.
something like
right.
that.
Yeah, I mean, one of the standards that all Head Starts are expected to meet is that families have what's called an individual family service plan, which is, here we've talked, we've found out things that are of concern to parents, whether it's, I need to get a GED, or I worry about food lasting through the month. We can hook people up with resources and help them, help the adults continue to meet their goals while we help the children learn and also help them as a unit.
When you said that, that just kind of struck me that when kids are young, we tend to think of serving them and their families, but that might not necessarily always be the mindset as they get older. Do you think it's a matter of shifting that mindset? Will that help keep these kids on the track that they're setting off with EduCare as they go into wherever they go to elementary school or middle school, high school? Or is it something else out of EduCare that's maybe a bigger takeaway as to why it's having such a big impact?
Well, I think, yeah, we could think about a couple potential things. What we can't do is unpack what parts of EduCare might be the most effective. We don't have that ability, but what we can speculate about is giving kids a rich environment where they're able to make choices and play and engage in beginning conversation rather than kind of being tucked away in an infant seat and put in front of a TV at a non-quality childcare setting, that can be important, that helping parents to reach their goals but also get a sense of efficacy. Families may not have had good experiences in school themselves. They may not feel that they know how to advocate for their child, be effective in schools, and for schools to understand what it takes to help parents get involved in today's world.
Just as somebody who's been an early ed teacher and you studied it, not just EduCare, but I'm sure all different kinds of programs, it seems to me like because there is no mandate for care or school at that age, and because the funding is sort of an issue, you know, there's an EduCare program here, there's a Head Start program here, there's a home care center here, and it all just seems very jumbled to me. Mm-hmm. Is there something that you think can come out of a study of a program like this, something that's effective, that maybe all of those different places that kids mm-hmm. go or families go can begin to look at least, just to kind of make sure every kid in Milwaukee who is getting some sort of early childhood, teachers are at least trying to go toward this goal or set them up for this as they send them off to where they go next?
So you use the word jumble of programs, and actually we have a technical term for it, which we call patchwork. So early, it's very technical. early childhood is a patchwork of programs. There are programs that are run by public schools. Here in Milwaukee, we call it K-4. The experiences that kids can have are so varied. It can be public school, it can be Head Start, it can be child care, and we know that child care varies in a huge range. And so we accept in our society that it's okay to have a range of quality for our children. We have home programs which can be both more intimate and nurturing or can be fairly unregulated and not so helpful to kids. We know as a field that infant toddler programs are among the most fraught in terms of quality. And we have more and more, as a society, we question about where babies should be, even if we've accepted by the time that kids are three, they could go to preschool, they could go to child care. So I think there's a lot to be done. The way that we look at it as early childhood education is every child who's four needs the same things and deserves the same things and has a right to a high-quality life. And no matter where they are, what kind of program, we would hope that child has those needs fulfilled. And we know that in our patchwork system, they don't. But there's a lot of work to do. And we also know that those programs that are high quality do have payoffs for kids.
Nancy Feil is a professor at UWM's School of Education. She was part of a national team of researchers who looked into the early childhood programming offered through EduCare. Dr. Feil spoke with Lake Effect's Rachel Morello. This week, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson traveled to Russia. His mission was to convince the Putin administration to back off from its support of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, who's accused of using poison gas on his own citizens as that country's civil war continues.
Lake Effect essayist Art Sears says those accusations greatly escalate the stakes in Syria.
I think the real failure here has been Russia's. That is how Secretary of State Rex Tillerson succinctly summed up the situation resulting from the use of poison gas in Syria. He was speaking on April 6 at a Florida airport, about to depart for visits to Italy and Russia. The administration has responded to the use of gas by attacking a Syria airbase with cruise missiles. The G7, shorthand for the Group of Seven, major trading nations convened in Lucca, Italy, an appropriate prelude to the difficult talks in Russia. War remains a scourge of human existence, but the total wars and unprecedented destructiveness of the 20th century resulted in commitment to international institutions. The G7 is part of this regime. Secretary Tillerson was referring to diplomatic intervention by President Vladimir Putin of Russia in 2013, following earlier use of poison gas in Syria. International agreements were reached to destroy the weapon stockpiles under international supervision. Russia played the leading role in persuading the Syrian government to abandon poison gas stockpiles. Given past duplicity by both Moscow and Baghdad, there were skeptics regarding this seemingly benign humanitarian intervention. They have now been confirmed. Use of gas has become a disturbing recurring problem in the seemingly endless turmoil of the Middle East. Faulty intelligence that the regime of Saddam Hussein of Iraq held weapons of mass destruction was used by officials of the administration of President George W. Bush to justify the 2003 invasion of that country. Earlier, Saddam Hussein's regime was supported by the U.S. in a long, brutal war with Iran. This occurred despite the fact that he used poison gas and genocidal attacks against the Kurd population in 1988. Which added credibility to later allegations. Poison gas, a grotesque weapon, has a distinctive as well as disturbing history. In World War I, gas was employed by both sides. The resulting agonizing and horrific mass deaths, combined with unpredictability of winds, has served generally to deter using such weapons since. In World War II, Italy and Japan used gas in Ethiopia and China. But Nazi Germany did not bring this weapon to the battlefield. Adolf Hitler had direct exposure to poison gas during combat in the trenches of World War I. The long, tangled tale of the Vietnam War highlights the extreme uncertainty which can accompany allegations about poison gas. After withdrawal of U.S. forces, the Hmong were targeted for ruthless retaliation in Laos as well as Vietnam. These fierce warriors had been loyal allies of America. In 1975, reports began to surface that Soviet poison gas was being used against the Hmong. U.S. Secretary of State Alexander Haig, in 1981, charged lethal T2 mycotoxin was the agent. Independent scientists, however, testified naturally occurring mass bee defecations were responsible for incidents of toxic, quote, yellow rain, unquote. In 1998, a widely touted CNN report alleged poison gas had been used by U.S. troops in Operation Tailwind, a Special Operations 1970 strike into Laos. The lurid and implausible story included accusations a main target was a group of American renegade defectors. The story was quickly discredited, and CNN personnel lost their jobs. An antidote to such poisonous irresponsibility is absolute commitment to confirming evidence while strengthening international mechanisms. In 1936, a weak international Red Cross refused to release evidence of Italian atrocities in Ethiopia. Inaction then finished the fragile League of Nations. The United Nations today must be a leader against the poison gas disease.
Foreign policy contributor Art Sear is a professor of political economy and world business and director of the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha.
Andrew McCarthy is a name known to many people of a certain generation for his acting in the movies of the late 1980s and 90s. Why a new generation may soon know his name when Lake Effect Weekend continues on WUWM.
Lake Effect Weekend continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. For a while in the 80s and early 90s, Andrew McCarthy's face was instantly recognizable for his acting work in movies such as Pretty in Pink and St. Elmo's Fire. You can't mention his name without invoking the term Brat Pack. So there we go.
McCarthy was also in other films as well, like The Joy Luck Club. But more recently, he's been a director on such high-profile projects as Orange is the New Black. But he's also an award-winning travel writer as well. In fact, he contends that's the work that has changed his life. He's an editor-at-large for National Geographic Traveler.
His life has more recently gone down another path as the author of a novel for young adults. Just Fly Away tells the story of 15-year-old Lucy Willows, who has just discovered a family secret and concludes that her life will seemingly never be the same. That book brought Andrew McCarthy to Milwaukee this week, and he visited with us in the Lake Effect studio. Welcome to the show. It's great to meet you.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thanks.
So I try not to read too many interviews ahead of interviews that I'm doing, but I did run across a handful of pieces for this new book or on this new book. And you seem to be getting a lot of the who are you to channel a 15-year-old girl kind of question a fair bit. So I won't ask you that question exactly. But I do wonder how your protagonist, Lucy Willows, showed up in your mind.
Yeah. Well, Lucy showed up by accident, really. I mean, I was writing another book. I thought I was writing another book for a number of years, like 5, 6, 7 years, really. I was writing a book about a man who had one night fling and a child came out of it. And he kept it a secret from his family. It was really a book about secrecy and marriage and what secrets do to a marriage. And over a long haul. And what bigger secret could one keep? So I started with that premise and I was writing it. And I wrote it, like I said, for years and years. And I could never crack it. And I put it down, and I wrote another book, and I did other things. And anyway, my favorite character in it was always the 15-year-old daughter, who was only 15 years old for about 15 pages in the book, because the book, that giant great American novel, took place over like 25 years. And so anyway, my favorite character, whenever I sort of rewrote for the umpteenth time that section of the book, I loved Lucy. And I found it very easy to write her. So then one day I was sitting on a plane, literally waiting to take off. We were delayed, and I just pulled out my computer and I just started typing. My dad has this other kid living across town. What's going on? And suddenly I was just writing from her perspective and her point of view, and everything about the book then changed.
And what's interesting about how you just put it there is the thing that really is compelling from the get-go is how that knowledge changes everything for Lucy. There's, you know, the finding out of her father's affair and the existence of her half-brother sort of divides everything into what came before and what will come afterwards.
Yeah, I love that moment in people's lives, the before and then after. And then there are several in each life, I think, and that's one for her. You know, in the book, it's interesting, this book has nothing in common with the other book that I was writing at all, except for this inciting incident. None of the plot is the same. But what was interesting to me was that all the characters were the same, the world was the same. So wherever I went, wherever Lucy sort of led me, I knew exactly the world that she was living in. I knew the relationships and the dynamics with all the people involved. So that was, it was as if the big book died in the woods and it was a nurse tree and this little book sucked all the nutrients out of it. I mean, that's the perfect sort of description in my mind. So, because this took everything that was good about that book, even though the plot is not at all the same.
Well, what do you think was what do you think was bad about that book?
Oh, why, I don't know. I don't know that it was particularly bad. It just didn't seem compelling in a certain way, and I think I had difficulty holding the momentum over 20-odd years. And, you know, I think one of the things that I was so close to that other character. I was writing from a close third person, but I was still very much like the father in many ways. That once I had the distance of Lucy, I was actually quite freed up. People don't seem to, you know. People seem to think that's odd, but it's like acting with an accent in a certain way. Suddenly words are coming out that you don't normally say and you're walking funny and but you're free in a certain way. I had a friend of mine who's a novelist, travel writer as well, the wonderful Pico Iyer. He said a line which I thought was great, that was I finished my travel book, and he said, what are you working on now? And I said, I'm struggling with a novel. And he said, oh, good, now you can put in all the things that were too personal to put in your memoir, which I think is exactly the truth.
So when you're writing this, are you Lucy?
Totally. I mean, I'm writing from the 15-year-old in myself to the 15-year-old in myself. What was interesting to me was diving into the YA genre, which I knew nothing about young adult literature, which I think is a sort of weird delineation. I'm not quite sure what the point is, but except that it's why literature seems to have, and today's seems to be very direct emotionally and unapologetic and tackles issues just head on right there in your face, which I really thought was, you know, interesting with Lucy, and she seemed absolutely of that.
Well, I was also wondering, I mean, you have, I think, what, 3 kids of your own?
I do. Feels like 30. Yeah.
Did you feel at any times parental towards Lucy when you were writing her?
I tried not to. I tried not to feel parental toward her because I tried to just follow her and keep up with her. I mean, it was the only time I've ever written anything where I didn't know how sentences were going to end when I started them, which was very exciting. The only thing I did right in the book was that I just had faith in process and just stepped out on each thing that she did. But no, I tried not to parent Lucy because and she's unreliable as an error in many ways. So, but what is interesting is that it didn't have the adult, you know, wisdom, for lack of a better word. She just had the sheer reaction and her emotional, visceral reaction, and that's what the world we were immersed in, which is one of the things that makes it YA. And so, as opposed to, I could have written this from an adult book and had some wisdom about it, I suppose. But no, I tried to completely stay out of the way, and when she was unlikable and did unlikable things, that's people.
Well, right, she's unreliable in so much as any 15-year-old is unreliable, not intentionally.
It's the truth to her. It's like, why isn't anybody else seeing this way I'm seeing it? What's the matter with everybody? Why does nobody understand me or appreciate me? Why am I so alone in the world? Will everybody else get their act together, please? Which, you know, many of us still feel like, except we have that adult voice in our head, which kind of goes, no, that might not actually be reality, but we can still feel that way. Whereas if you're 15, you're just discovering all this stuff and you just follow that.
And at the same time, most of us don't have the luxury of there being necessarily this one moment where we see a parent differently. It for a lot of us, might be more like the dripping of a leaky faucet.
That's very true, I think. But I think that's when we realize that our parents have their own individual lives and haven't been looking at us all the time and have, in fact, been looking away and doing their own things. I think it's a really terrifying moment. I mean, all of us want to be away from these horrible people that are nagging us all the time, our parents. And yet, when we discover that they are, I think it's a terrifying moment and a moment of betrayal. And that leads to all that teen angst and anger we often, you know, but I think it's very real because you've been very safe in the world. Your parents have been there watching out for everything, and then you realize that's not the case. Huh. And I think that is infuriating.
And at the same time, thinking about it from the standpoint of a parent, in a way, you know, and I hesitate to say this because my kids maybe are not yet old enough to have completely figured that out about their dad, but it's a little bit of a relief.
Well, I think eventually it's a relief, and I think it's, you know, a discovery of mixed feelings. You know, before adolescence, I don't know how much we're aware of mixed feelings, you know? And I think eventually it's a relief, but it's a process to get there. I think that's largely what the book is about, Lucy's process, and how does one deal with this issue that nobody else seems to need to grapple with.
Coming to terms with the fact that
my dad has this kid that he lied to us about, and don't you think that's kind of important that we should have known about that? and why isn't my mom reacting like she should be? And why is my sister oblivious and not care? It's like, what's going on with everyone?
All of her frames of reference are changing.
Yeah, and it's just her world turns on its axis and, you know, sets her about looking for answers, which, you know, one of the things I enjoy about Lucy is that she's just impulsive and, you know, she goes on a journey in the book, but it has no intention of going on a journey. She just sort of goes out the door, and then she turns left, and then she turns right, and then suddenly that happens, and she's far from home, and oh, wow. You know, it's one of the things I love about, I'm a great believer in the value of escape. I mean, I'm a travel writer in my other life. I love the notion of escape, and I often feel like we're escaping to the very thing we need to find as opposed to running away from things. I often don't know what I'm looking for, and then I run smack into it, and I would have gone, oh, that's what it was I was looking for. And that's been my experience in life. I mean, travel has been sort of the university of my life. My growth has come from hitting the road alone and then being confronted with issues that were revelatory to me.
This is a perfect transition into perhaps a
That's
little—
That's the business we're in, isn't it? The transition business?
Spectacular segue. There is a section where, and I don't know, this is obviously not a spoiler because you just mentioned it. Lucy goes on a road trip, sort of an inadvertent road trip to Maine to see her grandfather. And it would be great if you could share just a little bit of her getting going on this trip.
She gets on a train. She happens to find herself at a train station as without any intention of boarding one, and then she does. I almost skipped on board. I turned left and went into the forward car. There were plenty of seats, but I walked to the very front of the car and then all the way to the back. The train started to gather speed, and I was looking out the windows left and right, walking back up the aisle, swaying side to side with the motion. I felt giddy. I ended up on the left side in the window seat near the front for no reason. I'd taken the train into the city only a few times in my entire life, once when my dad's car was broken and we were going to the circus, and another time when my mom took my sister and me to see a matinee, and one other time when some friends and I went ice skating at Rockefeller Center. Otherwise, my dad drove us. Not that we went into the city all that much. Trains are very pleasant, except for the fact that very few things actually face the railroad track, so consequently, you're usually looking at the back of people's lives. The people throw a lot of junk out the back of their buildings. My view is scarred by their debris. The redeeming thing about all this, however, is that the scenery moves by so quickly on a train. The instant you see some rusted car, empty derelict swimming pool, things that were originally intended to bring joy, the view changes and you can forget all about the sorry sight and take in the next little disappointment that life out your window has to offer. It was good to be in motion. Lucy.
Well,
I like her.
I do too, and that realization of what you see from a train is something that I think all of us, anybody who's taken a train trip, there's this romantic notion of what it will be like, and then there's the reality.
Yeah, no, I've always thought that was nobody ever talks about that. That like you're always looking at junk and out the back, and it's just not that attractive. Things are not geared toward, you know, it's not front of house.
And there's a reason that the people talk about the other side of the tracks.
I suppose there is. You know, when I was young, I used to go to the railroad tracks in my youth and just sort of alone. And I used to just sort of hang around there and flatten pennies. And it has a place of strange melancholy, wistfulness about it and danger, you know, the implicit danger of it and something about it.
The last line there, it felt good to be in motion. Can you talk about the emotion that you get from being in motion? I mean, is it happiness? Is it something else?
I think it's inherently a sense of optimism in a certain way. And I just read this line somewhere. I can't tell you who said it, but a man with no past is happy. A man with nothing but a past is not. I'm misquoting, of course. But so when you're traveling, you're in motion, it's as if you have no past. You only have future, and you're just right here looking forward only. It's very American that way. Paul Theroux, the great travel writer, said, you know, travel is optimism in motion. And I just think that's true.
What is it about sharing those experiences or those discoveries with people that attracts you to travel writing?
Well, travel changed my life in a very real way, and it was Paul Theroux's books that did it. You know, I read one of the old Patagonian Express, I believe, train book, and he opened my eyes to a way of traveling that I had never conceived of before, and so I started traveling that way, alone and into the world and without plan and without a net, as it were, and I found it revelatory. You know, I just thought it changed the way I perceived myself in the world and the way I looked at the world. So to me, travel had value. It had real purpose. It wasn't, you know, something for the wealthy or the, you know, frivolous or people with idle time. It was a real thing of value to do, and a lot of the travel I was reading about didn't bring that to it. It was selling places. So I just started writing first-person experiential travel stuff that seemed to resonate with people, because underneath every article that I write, whether I'm writing about Paris or wherever, is that this is important. It changed my life. It can change yours. This matters. And so I think people resonate with that.
Do you think people put too much pressure on having experiences without being necessarily just open to experiencing whatever comes their way?
Well, a lot of travel is not fun. Travel isn't necessarily supposed to be fun, in my mind. I'm not looking for, you know, trophies or various things. I mean, a lot of travel is boring, hard, lonely, all sorts of things. I just become revealed to myself when I travel. It helped me walk through a lot of fear that I possessed in my life. So I think often people expect the wrong thing of travel. It's not supposed to be this greatest hits of our life every moment of the day. That's not what the point. But that's vacation. I'm not much of a vacationer. I don't really believe in vacation. So what do I do on the beach after the first 10 minutes? I don't know. know. So, but I like traveling, which is very different, which is also just putting yourself vulnerable out into the world and asking to be received by the world.
Is it at all odd for you to be doing this version of travel, the version that takes you to bookstores and radio stations and TV studios?
Well, yeah, because people say, oh, this must be great. You must love this. Traveling, I go, this is the anti-travel. This is everything that I don't like about it. It's just hotels to places, to venues, to hotels, to airports and things. So it's not really travel to me. It's just going from place to place, which I actually do enjoy. There's a thrill in arrival that is undeniable, like just arriving here an hour ago in Milwaukee. It's just like, whoa, I don't know this place. And there's a sense of thrill about it.
Do you think about the audience for this new book, what the 13 or 14 or 15-year-olds are going to be left with when they finish reading it?
Well, what I was surprised to find out was the majority of YA readers are actually adults. But hopefully, you know, when I wrote the book, what do I know about being a 15-year-old girl? And I wrote the book in kind of a bubble. Once I started it, I didn't show it to anyone. I normally inflict a lot of my writing on my wife, and I didn't even tell anyone I was making this transition because I already had this book. What was I doing? So I wrote it sort of in secrecy. And then when I finished it, I gave it to my neighbor who was 15. I asked her to read it, and she said, who wrote it? What is it? And I just read it and don't tell your parents. And anyway, she read it and said, this sounds like me and my friends, which was a huge relief, of course. But I suppose what you always want is just people to nod their head and go, yeah, that's me. I understand that. I have been doing a lot of interviews since I've started talking about the book. I've been shocked to find out that people, at least 24 people have come up to me and told me on a literal level about secret siblings and people that knocked on their door 30 years ago and go, I'm your sister. People that showed up at funerals and, you know, stepfather who turned out to be the biological father. I was talking to a reporter the other day and he was very cold to me on the phone and very distant. And I was like, wow, this guy really hated the book. I don't know why he's bothering to talk to me. I can't wait to get off the phone with him. And then right at the end, he goes, yeah, a little, full disclosure, I am the product of a one-night fling, and I never knew my father, and I have two siblings that I've never met that live a few towns over. And I'm like, dude, that's my book. You know, so he had this very strong reaction, which he wasn't allowing himself to go to in a certain way. But then we had a great discussion. But so there's a lot of it, you know, there's a lot of secrets out there, you know.
Do you have a sense for how long after the events of this book Lucy is recounting them?
Oh, interesting. It's not that long. A few months, 6 months. Just like the way when we think we know something when we're young, that was a long time ago. And it was like, you know, 8 weeks ago. You know, I'd say several months, you know, because she's beginning to process. But she's still not there.
Right. You know? I was trying to figure out if she knew that she was going to be okay.
I mean, Lucy's going to be a great adult. She just has to get there. That's how I always thought of her. When I did parent her, I always knew she's going to be a great adult, so I don't have to worry about her. As long as I don't get her hit by the train, she's going to be fine. You know what I mean? So I kept that in my mind all the time.
I think it's an underrated part of adolescence, not just the realization that your parents are flawed, but at some point figuring out that you're going to figure it out.
Well, I remember when I was young, staring in the mirror and like, because I looked so young and literally staring in the mirror going, please let me just know what it's going to be like, look like in 10 years, what I'm going to look for just for a second so that I know it's going to be okay. Because there's a very real feeling that I was always afraid my life just is not going to begin here. And on one hand, your world is everything and you're the most important thing in it. And yet on the other hand, it's like, it's never going to happen. So it's a difficult moment.
And then you wake up and it is 20 years later.
And you're still asking the same things.
Listen, Andrew McCarthy, it really is a terrific book.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thanks. We gotta make it last. Touch you once, I touch you twice. I won't let go at any
price. I need you now, like I need you now. Andrew McCarthy's new book for young adults is called Just Fly Away. He's also editor-at-large for National Geographic Traveler. He's directed TV shows such as Orange is the New Black and Grace and Frankie.
And, of course, he starred in some pretty iconic movies over the years, including Less Than Zero and Pretty in Pink, not to mention Mannequin and Weekend at Bernie's.
Lake Effect Weekend returns with our storytelling series Exfabula right after this. You're listening to us on 89.7 WUWM.
Three, two, one.
Welcome to Exfabula!
True
personal story.
Exfabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
And it is Exfabula Radio time once again on Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bruce Winter. Leah Delaney is here, the co-founder of Milwaukee Exfabula. And every week at this time, true live personal stories from Milwaukee area folks taken from past Exfabula story slams and events. And there's a theme every week. And we may have had this season's last story slam, Leah, but the big kahuna is coming up next month.
Yes, the All-Stars is coming up in May. But I'm still riding off the high from our story slam from this past week when the theme was only in Milwaukee.
And the theme on the radio this week
is actually revolving around one of our fellowship events coming up on April 27th. So we have a fellowship event wrapping around the theme of community conversations with the theme of fair schools. So on April 27th, Exfabula Fellows will continue their dialogue addressing race, privilege, and oppression. This time, it's going to be a community conversation about equity, diversity, and educational achievement. And the event will begin with a brief keynote from Reggie Jackson, MPS teacher and head Riot of America's Black Holocaust Museum. And for those of you who don't know what Riot is, I had to look it up myself. It is a West African term meaning historian and storyteller. So we're in for quite a treat with that. And also, after Reggie Jackson speaks, we're going to roll into a couple of our Exfabula fellows who are going to share topical true personal stories based upon that theme. And if you want more information about it and registration, you can be found at exfabula.org.
Personal plug, Reggie Jackson was on our panel at our segregated Milwaukee panel, and the guy is great.
So let's roll into the stories. Our first story today, based on the theme of fair schools and experiences with such, is from Kima Hamilton. And those who don't know who Kima Hamilton is, he is a fantastic spoken word artist, and yet the guy can tell a heck of a real true personal story, as he is no stranger to the Exfabula stage. So let's roll into Kima Hamilton's story.
Recently, I attended my 20th class reunion and from Lee County High School, Leesburg, Georgia. And I was really, when I got the date, I was really excited about this class reunion because I lived in Milwaukee and, you know, I'd been living in Alaska for 15 years and, you know, it's an incredible place, but the thing that I miss the most are road trips, or just kind of getting in a car in one state and then getting out of a car in another state. And that's possible there, but it takes a few days. So you know, I wasn't going to book a flight. I was going to, you know, get in a car and drive home just for the, you know, for the experience of it. And it was everything I thought it would be and a lot more. I left Milwaukee. So I'm in music mode. So I'm driving and I'm listening to music and I'm crossing state lines and everything's feeling great. I get into Tennessee and of course, you know, it's country music on the, you know, on the radio stations. And I didn't necessarily mind that. Like one of the things that I think has worked for me as a DJ is that I did, like Lee County is a predominantly white school. So I grew up listening to a lot of country music in the shared spaces, weightlifting, and so on. So it was actually neat to kind of even take that trip down memory lane, in that sweet spot, you know, that sweet spot of 90s Garth Brooks country. And I started, you know, like in road trip, you have especially that 15 hour when there's a lot of time to think. So I'm, you know, thinking about going home. And so the country music kind of led me into that, the reminder, I guess, that I am driving back into the context where I'm, you know, will be one of the only black people there, which is, you know, which was what it was, if you will. So there's a black history program every year at my high school. And if you would imagine being in that minority situation, like that day meant a lot to us. Someone sang Amazing Grace every year. We sang the Black Negro National Anthem. It was official. So, but the disappointing part, though, every year it was tradition for most of the white students to elect out of attending school that day, and the parents were allowed to, it was basically an excused absence. The pushback on the day was that was a day they were being force-fed Black history, and it wasn't fair. And so you know, for, you know, and even at that age, you knew that wasn't okay, right? It was disappointing, but it was what it was. Another tradition was, you know, every day, every morning of the Black History Program, there'd be a Confederate flag on the water tower, which was another part of the tradition there. So there was the interesting part about that is because it happened multiple years, you almost, you know, in a really dark way, you look forward the morning of being one of the Black students, right? And go, yeah, there it is, right? There was never really a discussion about who did it, and I think, you know, there was a part of me that didn't really want to push that issue. There was. It's interesting being a Black male, being a 6-foot Black male, right? You're doing this dance of knowing how disappointing this is, passionate you want to express that, right? But then you don't want to enter that, you know, angry Black male space, which discounts everything that you're saying in the first place, right? So and as a high school student, you know that you'd start doing this dance, and just like high school, I just kind of in this way decided to just kind of sit that over there. This is going to be a great weekend, and I set it back in the closet that it's been in, and finished the road trip, drove into homecoming, and left the homecoming game, went to doodads, you know, you've done the class reunion thing. Like, it sounds as fun as it was, right? It's a place called Doodads. Closed that joint and ended up at one of my classmates. So we're back at the house doing the after party to the after. And when you're 40, the after party looks like, you know, standing around talking about kids and family and you know, your professional life. And there's a point there where, for as much fun as I'm having right now, for as good as this feel, and I had a great experience in high school, and so this paralleled the weekend, right? I still want to know who hung up this flag, and being an adult now, I was really struggling figuring out why I won't ask right now, right? I know that I can ask. I know that, you know, at this point I can even handle hearing the answer, and differently than I could have in high school, right? And decided not to ask, and to keep laughing and to keep eating and to keep hugging, and so now I'm back in the car after a great weekend, headed up the highway, crossing state lines. The good news is now that, you know, we're at this stage in life, we'll have opportunities every 5 years now to ask who hung up the flag.
And that was Kima Hamilton's story based on the theme today, which we are talking about is fair schools.
Oh, high school and high school reunions. How did Dickens put it? The best of times, the worst of times?
Yeah.
Story number two for today.
Yes. So let's roll right into our second story today. It's from one of our Exfabula fellows. His name is Nakia Hood. So let's listen to Nakia's story.
I've always loved education. But I remember at a young age just being crushed for my love of education and having it zapped out of me, so to speak. It all started back in second grade. I remember the summer after finishing second grade, and we were out. It was me, my two sisters, my cousins. We were out playing in the yard, and the mailman came with our report cards. So my aunt came. She had the mail. She started reading off the report cards. Promoted to this grade, she would say, in the way only Aunt Lucy can, and she was just celebrating everybody's accomplishments. But then it came to me, and I was just waiting for my pat on the back just like everyone else. And then she opened the report card, and it said demoted. I'm like, man, I didn't even know what demoted meant, but I realized it very soon. So when I started back in second grade again, what came along with second grade was being put in what is known as special education, but at the time they just called it LD, learning disability. How demeaning, right? Because to this day, I still feel like I don't have a learning disability. And also what came with that, from second grade to seventh grade, you had to go to summer school in order to pass, which didn't really make sense to me. I'm in school, I'm doing the work, but I gotta go to summer school? But a miracle, I like to call it, happened in seventh grade. Teacher got pregnant. I guess that is a miracle. But the other miracle was we got a substitute teacher. And I noticed she would always stare at me and see me doing my work. Because here's how LD went in seventh grade. You get a packet of work on Monday, and you have to have it finished by Friday. So I'm thinking, let me finish this real simple work so I can sit in the back of the class, eat snacks, you know, watch TV, do my LD thing. I got used to it. But they pulled me out of class with the substitute teacher, and they made me take a test. And what normally happens, if you pass on this test, you get to go to regular class. Well, I guess I scored decent enough. They pulled me out. I was in regular class the next week. Looking back, LD, people don't like for me to call it that because it's special ed now, but I still feel LD. Looking back, I always wondered, why did they take me out of class? Oh, thank you. Why did they take me out of class? Looking back, I realized things such as white privilege, institutional racism, my favorite, soft bigotry. What is that? And that's kind of what happened to me, because also in those classes, the LD classes, the only people that were participating in those were kids who looked like me and what society calls white trailer trash. And the affluent kids went to what was called AG, academically gifted. And the difference between the two was the professional opinion of the teacher placing the kids in AG and LD. Well, make a long story short, I can stand here and say I just graduated from college with a degree in psychology. And I'm now looking to go in the special education field so I can express my love of education.
And that was Nakia Hood's story based on education and his personal experience. We have a lot of stuff coming up to wrap up our season, if I may. We have a storytelling workshop coming up on Wednesday, April 19th. On April 27th, we have another Exfabula Fellowship session. So please, all information about that, including registration, is at exfabula.org. And let us not forget our theme for the All-Stars, as you called it, the Big Kahuna.
The Big Kahuna.
Is unfinished business.
Ooh.
So we have all of the people, we have all the audience favorites gathered up, and people have already started churning out their stories and getting their minds going. So it's going to be quite an event.
That's a good theme for that show.
It really is.
Oh, man.
Yeah, that's going to be a real crowd pleaser, I think.
Well, if you want to share these stories you hear on the radio, you can do that because we have them posted at WUWM.com. And we're here every Saturday and Sunday right at this time during Lake Effect Weekend. Leah, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Exfabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up the show today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4, and be sure to tune in to the weekday version of the show at 10 o'clock in the morning.
It is all on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned now for Weekend All Things Considered. It's coming up next. It's 4 o'clock.